It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. I'm Suzanne Lang. We're going to talk today with authors Elizabeth Evans and Jean Wong. Let's start by listening to Elizabeth Evans reading from her book, As Good as Dead.
The bulky Esme Cole Fletcher who stood on Will's and my front steps, she looked so different from the Esme whom I remembered that even after I had opened the inner door and said her name through the screen, I needed her teasing reprimand, "Charlotte, c'est moi," before a current began to flow between us. Weak at first, then that dull, chunky lady began to acquire a soft glow, and it was Esme, and joy is what I felt, alongside a dread that must have made my face go white. Yes, in 1988 there had been lovely times between my workshop friend and myself, such as a fall morning when side by side we knelt on the kitchen linoleum and dent by dent, using the nails of our little fingers, pressed our names, Charlotte, Esme, into the many coats of built-up yellowed enamel on the cupboards. Even better, once we finished, Esme added a plus sign between our names, Esme plus Charlotte, as if we were sweethearts. Also true, at the end of that year's Thanksgiving vacation, I had spent an idiotic blotto evening sloshing around on the chilly waterbed of Esme's workshop boyfriend, an Alabamian named Jeremy Fletcher, whom I generally regarded as a blowhard. The worst thing I ever did in my entire life. A thoroughly ridiculous person. That was what I had been.
That was Elizabeth Evans reading from her book, As Good as Dead. A little later in the broadcast, Rosemary Manchester is in to talk with Jean Wong, author of Sleeping with the Gods. Elizabeth Evans is the author of 6 books of fiction and is professor emeritus for creative writing at the University of Arizona. Like the protagonist of her latest work, Evans received her MFA from the famed Iowa Writers' Workshop. Let's listen to our conversation. Elizabeth Evans, As Good as Dead, your just-released novel. Welcome to Sonoma County.
Thank you, thank you.
We're going to talk somewhat about the characters in the book in just a minute. The book is kind of set with a background of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which you graduated from. Yes?
Yes.
Have you also taught there?
No, but I have been a professor of creative writing for 27 years at the University of Arizona.
For our readers and listeners, I think many people have heard of the Iowa Writers Workshop and the real proliferation of MFAs, and certainly a lot of the authors that I talk to have MFAs or have been through programs, and certainly we see it as credentials that people have on their book jackets. And you chose to have that the setting of your book.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about that in a minute. Why should I, as a reader, pay attention to who has an MFA or not and where it's from?
Well, I think that certainly writers don't need to have an MFA, but it is something that many people will put on their book jackets. I graduated, and often from the Iowa Writers' Workshop. The MFA is really, it's a fine degree, and, you know, it certainly doesn't seem to me that it produces sort of a homogenized kind of writing. It gives an opportunity to writers to be with their kind, to be with others who feel like spending 2 or 3 years working on your writing and probably doing some teaching in a university setting is a very good thing to do. And not all the world will understand that, but the people that you're working with will feel like, yes, this is something very important. So it gives a lot of support to the idea that you're doing something worthwhile.
And writing is, I would say, a solitary activity.
Yes.
But it's a lot of work, and maybe frustrated writers don't put in the work, or people who don't. And in fact, in your book, that's manifested as well. Not
yes.
everybody does the work. So an MFA program provides a structure in a way.
Mm-hmm. And there are people who find that they need a structure. And some of those people, after an undergraduate program or after a master's program, without the structure, find that it's very difficult for them to write. So I went to school with many, many talented people, and not everyone kept on writing. It is not, you know, a failure necessarily to quit writing. It's just you have to want to do it more than you want to do anything else in the whole world in order to keep doing it. Because nobody's going to be asking you, write some more. You know, there's a lot of writing being done in the world. So you have to really want to do it in order to produce it.
And it seems like these programs expose young writers to other successful writers and maybe even provide some inroads into the publishing business?
There is that. One thing that you have in a master's program is you're being taught by other writers. You're being taught by published writers. So you have the model of, you know, here's an example of, you know, someone who has gone on and made this the life's work. That's an important model to have as a writer.
And your book, As Good as Dead, is set amidst people who have been in the Iowa Writers Workshop, and then one of the characters goes on to teach at the university. So why did you choose to have that as the setting or part of the element of your book?
Well, the Iowa Writers Workshop is very famous, and it's famous because it has famous teachers and the students go on to become well known. And it's also well known as a place where there's a very competitive atmosphere. People are jockeying for positions, hoping to find agents, hoping to find publishers, make contacts in the world. So it was a wonderful spot in which I have a story of highly competitive feelings take place.
And I would say that the book is not as much about the life of a writer as much as it is about human insecurity and throwing in with a little bit of alcoholism.
Yes. I'm very interested in relationships, as are most writers. So I'm very interested in how people work out their relationships, you know, be it between husbands and wives or friends. And in this case, it's two female friends, Charlotte and Esme. And when the book opens, Charlotte, who is now 41 and a writer, goes to her front door and she finds her old graduate school classmate, Esme, standing there. And the two had a very dramatic friendship when they were younger, and Charlotte really adored this charismatic, city-wise, wealthy Esme. And Charlotte was sort of the blue-collar, small-town girl, and she was confused sometimes by Esme's behavior and felt hurt by her behavior, and she ended up betraying her. And so when she goes to her front door and there's Esme standing there, she's like, oh, is this a wonderful thing? Can I now make up to my friend who I betrayed in the past? Or is this bad news? And she isn't quite sure at first. And what the story really that's about exploring is how, well, Charlotte has to go back and look at the past. And that was in a time when she was drinking. And as an adult, she's a recovered alcoholic. She goes to AA, and she's learned things there that have really helped her. But she's also kept some secrets. And these are secrets that perhaps Esme knows. She knows some of them. And those secrets have distorted Charlotte's life in ways that she also has to look at during the course of the story. So there are two big time periods, that Iowa time and then this time of Esme appearing in her life again.
And you move us through that remembrance, through the recapping of what happened when they were in school. And for the reader, there's a fluid movement through time as we get pieces filled in and get a little bit of that experience of them as young people. And what struck me about Charlotte was that she may have stopped drinking, but she still harbored that insecurity about who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that intriguing and very real.
Yes.
That she's a successful woman. She has stuck with her writing. She has a fabulous husband. But on some level, she doesn't believe it all.
And I think that has a lot to do with keeping those secrets from the past. She says, of herself in the past, saying something that she's heard at the AA meetings, was I an egomaniac with an insecurity complex? There's still some traces of that, and I think a lot of it comes from keeping those secrets. And she does have a loving husband, but there are ways in which she sort of distorted her marriage by keeping certain secrets. She's maybe denied herself some things that she wouldn't have had to had she been able to really be more candid in her life.
And really, everything that she experienced with Esme. And with there's another character who is Charlotte's husband's Will, and then there's another character, Jeremy Fletcher, and you seem to always refer to him as Jeremy Fletcher with the two names, and he's he did not carry on, or nor did Esme carry on their writing careers. And that was interesting to see what was driving them and kind of surprising. But he was a wunderkind type of student, perhaps, but maybe only ever produced one piece of writing that was worth anything. And do you see a lot of that in actuality with students?
Yes, and there are people sometimes who will apply to a program with a good piece of writing or the beginnings of a good piece of writing, and they never really go on to produce anything else, or they never complete that one piece of writing. Sometimes many years later, they will finish things. Like I said, it's almost like the tortoise and the hare sometimes, that it's that one that keeps on plugging. And I recently had a student who told me, I remember you saying this, that if I just kept on writing, and that I would be one of the people who would probably succeed. And she has. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's wonderful, wonderful news, to hear. Because I do think so much of it is a matter of really just keeping your nose to the grindstone and loving it. It's very hard, but it's also the case that most of us who do it, it's the thing we love to do most.
And in As Good As Dead, I wasn't sure about Charlotte, because some of it seemed like she could have gone the way of Esme and maybe not continue to write. Yet her marriage with Will, it seemed like he's supported that and provided a context for her to value her writing. And maybe she didn't realize that. I don't know. But I found it interesting dynamics between all these characters, and that the secrets that she bore were similar to secrets that many of us do.
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. And I think it's a very realistic story. I don't think it's a highly extraordinary story. What makes it of interest, you know, is the telling of it, turning up motivations and exploring things and providing details. I think you can take lives that are quite ordinary, and simply by, you know, turning the light on them and, you know, physically describing things in a compelling way, you know, they become mysterious and they become suspenseful, you know. And people have been telling me over and over, oh, I couldn't put this down. I just had to read it straight through. And as you say, you know, they're not extraordinary events, but it's most of our lives are not examined in this way. And so we sometimes don't even know the mysteries of our own lives. And I'm very interested in just that idea itself. In particular, here's a person who's a writer and should, in, you know, conceivably know more about herself than she has known. And she does not write this story. I write it, you know. It's a book written by Elizabeth Evans. So that in itself makes it a little bit different. You know, I think she has learned things about her life. I've learned things about her life, too.
Also, you describe her family and her relationships in ways that were pretty clear and explicit about her father and mother, for instance. And she spends some time with her sister who has cancer. And in that, she almost feels she's taking making a stance that would that threaten her getting tenure, but she has to do what she feels she has to do in getting to know her sister at this point of life.
Yes, yes. She comes from a family that her sister was much older than she, and when she becomes ill, Charlotte goes back to the little hometown in Iowa and takes care of her sister, and spends about 18 months taking care of her. And Charlotte is in a profession where taking off time like that is kind of frowned upon. But it's a good experience for her. They really get to know each other in a way they hadn't. And it also gives me a chance to show some things about the family of origin. Charlotte's really a person who, her being a writer was completely foreign to her family. And they don't quite understand the fiction-making process exactly. You know, if she writes something about a family, they assume that it's about them. And she tries to explain to them, you know, that's not really what a fiction writer does. A fiction writer's trying to make meaning out of all of the flux of life.
Yes, the mother comments at one point about, you know, you made me that way.
Yes, I didn't look good in that one. Yes.
Well, that probably is a real pitfall for writers who certainly probably do mine a certain amount of material, but then, as you say, use it. I like that. Use it to create meaning.
Yes, yeah. And it's interesting. I heard you interview another fellow recently, and he was talking about the fact that when you use this material in a novel, and you draw little bits here and there from your real life, some of it doesn't belong to you anymore. And it becomes very difficult even to think which of these things are real and which did I make up? Because you've given them to your readers now. So that's a thing to contend with. And I think people sometimes later in life are, you know, a little more careful. I know I have been much more careful as I've gotten older about what things I would draw upon from my own life, because you want to have some of your own memories to keep as you grow older.
Yes. And I imagine there are people who maybe are wondering if you're the prototype for Charlotte.
There are things that are similar in our backgrounds. I'm from Iowa, and I did go to the workshop, but our lives are very different. I grew up in a very different kind of family. I grew up in a family that had lots of art books, and I took drawing classes and, you know, read a great deal. And I can't say that my parents necessarily understood my wanting to be a fiction writer, but they were happy to send me off to college and so on.
I want to get back into something you just said a minute ago about describing, putting a spotlight on these people's lives. And it's something that obviously you enjoy a great deal, just because your writing is so descriptive of details that about action, about setting, about even table setting, maybe even. So is that something that is obviously you enjoy getting into the world of the fiction that way?
Yes, yes. And I'm always paying attention to detail. In fact, we went out for lunch today and I noticed that we were sitting at a very small table with the silverware and napkins set out. And I noticed how the fellow who was our waiter had to carefully draw out the menus from underneath the place setting so he wouldn't throw everything onto the floor. And I thought, you know, now he's learned to do that. And I have been a waitress myself. So I thought he's learned to do that from experience, you know, because you've probably dumped the silverware on the floor in the past. So, yeah, I'm always paying attention. And it's just essential to have those details. I even talk about that a bit in the book, that the Charlotte in the mode of a teacher is saying, you know, if you don't make the reader believe that the physical world exists and that you could, say, knock silverware off on the floor, then it's impossible to believe that the actions of the characters could have consequences. In order for there to be consequences, there has to be a very solid, real world around your characters.
And I felt like I could visualize how they looked as well, their descriptions of the physicality.
Yes, I try to reassert what the people look like and how they're gesturing and so on, because I feel like if you don't continue to do that, they'll sort of slip out of the reader's mind. So I try to keep putting those details back in, making you see how characters are behaving, how they're gesturing, you know, expressions on their faces and so on. And, you know, they're so endlessly interesting anyway, you know, out in the world. I'm always jotting things down that I see.
So how'd the story get kicked off?
Well, it was kind of interesting. I was probably about 20 years old, and I was talking to someone, a woman who was quite a bit older than I was, and she told me a story about having received a visit from her college roommate. And she was very surprised. She hadn't seen this woman in many, many years. And it turned out that this woman had a favor to ask. And it turned out to be a rather horrible favor. And that story just stayed with me. And I was working on a novel a couple years ago, and I one day was walking by my dresser, and I just sort of jotted some notes down on the back of this bill about that story. And I, because I always had thought, you know, I want to write something about that someday. And every once in a while, when I'd be walking around the house, I would jot something down. And then one day I couldn't find that sheet of paper, and I thought, I've got to write this down. So I started working on the story. And I took a break from the novel. And it actually, for a time, I was trying to make it be a short story, but I kept having to throw parts of it out, and it ended up being a whole big book, you know.
So it was calling at you. It was. It demanded to be written almost.
Yes.
So you now have maybe other scraps of paper around.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I have so many scraps. Uh-huh. I have so many scraps. And just the other day I wrote one down. This man was saying how he was sitting at the dinner table with his wife and two daughters, and the daughter said, "Mom, we've got to find a way to get rid of Dad." All right. Got to take a note on that.
Yes. Well, when I was reading the book, I had a little sense of dread reading it, that somebody was... maybe I don't want to say too much because I don't want to give too much away, but there is an edge to the way you describe these things that, but I want to get back to almost the normality of these people. We make our own edges sometimes,
yes.
You know, with secrets, that sometimes should have been dealt with a long time ago, and then they loom large.
Yes.
But I felt for Charlotte because I think she really wanted something from Esme and always did and was thwarted about that many times. I felt bad for her in a way.
Yes, I did too.
Yeah. But sometimes we learn lessons the hard way.
That's right.
And I noticed that you just mentioned short stories, that you write short stories and novels. And so some require something different, I guess.
The big difference, I think, is this opportunity to explore the character over time. You know, the story, often a story can be a short story. But if you really want to spend time showing the character go through changes, then having the novel makes the big difference. Yes.
And sometimes maybe, like with this one, you thought it could be one thing, but it turned out another.
That's absolutely right. It ended up, I thought initially it was a story about the female friendship, and it turned out being a story about a whole life.
And we didn't really talk a lot about that whole aspect of her drinking and her association with AA, which I found interesting, actually, that she really would describe just how good she felt after having
a drink, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, she says, you know, like he remembers that, you know, feeling of how she described it, like a fire hose blast of vodka, you know, clearing the crap out of my head or something to that effect. But then she always reminds herself, no, you know, alcohol and I were never, ever going to get to be friends again. I think she knows that, you know, it's like that first drink, as most alcoholics could say, you know, it's like the first drink feels good, but then what the alcoholic is always doing is chasing the feeling of the first drink, and never can get it back. And there's also the unpredictability of what she might do if she has a drink.
it was never good.
Never good, yes. Never good. What she finds in AA is how to get along with people. That's one of the big things. And she has a sponsor, and the sponsor talks about this, AA as a civilizing influence. And that's very important in her life. She's learned how to be a friend.
And her AA sponsor, during a time of crisis, when Charlotte went to her kind of exasperated, she, I don't remember the woman's name.
Jacqueline.
With only her last initial. It wasn't...
Yeah, Jacqueline C, right?
Anonymity was preserved. But she said something very blunt to Charlotte that once it was said, both of them kind of knew it had been an honesty that maybe Charlotte hadn't
dealt with. I know what you're talking about. I don't think they'll mention what it is.
Right, but, right. Yes. No, we don't want to give away any of the secrets here. And speaking of that, I imagine this is a book that book clubs are attracted to.
Yes, yes. And the publisher does have a guide for, Bloomsbury has a guide for the book clubs.
Well, I enjoyed the book As Good as Dead, and I want to thank you for coming in today, and all the best with it.
Thank you so much.
My conversation with Elizabeth Evans on her book, As Good as Dead. Let's take a little break with Rachel Sage and Judy Collins. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea, and I'm Suzanne Lang. When we return, Rosemary Manchester talks with author Jean Wong on her book, Sleeping with the Gods. So stay with us. Rachel Sage and Judy Collins with Neil Young's Helpless from Rachel's album Blue Roses. This is KRCB's A Novel Idea, and I'm Suzanne Lang. Greek and Roman gods emerge from the shadows of history and intersect with everyday life in Jean Wong's Sleeping with the Gods. Here she talks with longtime contributor Rosemary Manchester.
Your book is called Sleeping with the Gods, Immortal Stories by Jean Wong. I love it. I've been dying to ask you where the inspiration came. Well, from the gods, of course. But the inspiration for these, they're unusual stories.
Well, a lot of people are asking me, well, you must know a lot about, you know, Greek and Roman gods. But to tell you the truth, I know nothing about, you know, I've never been a, well, I did take 2 years of Latin. But other than that, I'm not some classical scholar of any kind. I'm in a Friday writing class in Sonoma, and we're assigned a topic. We assign each other a topic every week. Well, this particular week, someone assigned Mercury. And so I walk in the class, and some people had written on the element Mercury, you know, like in a thermometer or something like that. But one girl wrote about the god Mercury. And she described his characteristics, and as you know, Mercury is fast, he's changeable, not really very reliable, he can lie. And when she was describing him, I thought, I used to have a boyfriend just like that. And I just, you know, and it was that kind of situation where you're in a, you kind of meet someone and you kind of want it to work, and he's gorgeous and you like him, but there, he says or does something that you go, wait a minute, that was weird, or that's strange, you know. But you want it to work, and so you just sort of keep. So anyway, that was the impetus, and then I wrote that one, and after that, I thought of Venus, and I thought of, you know, another one and another one, and you know, I was on a roll.
You certainly were, yeah. And it, for me, it really, really works to see how you've, the various ways in which you work the stories around the characteristics of the gods and goddesses. I want to read to our audience what Terry Arrett wrote about your book. She says, "Sleeping with the Gods romps through the unexpected intersection of everyday life and myth. But not the myths you learned in school. Each god or goddess has a contemporary persona. Mercury is a beachcombing gigolo in Kauai. Venus is a hitchhiker along the Columbia River Gorge. Hestia is a caretaking android. Whether you're familiar with the classic tales or discovering the gods for the first time, you'll find these divine encounters engaging, humorous, haunting, sexy, and savvy, with deep insights into human nature."
That particular blurb was wonderful, because, and I often read it myself, because not only is it glowing, but it also gives you – it's a hard book to sort of describe explain to people.
That's right.
But it completely, in a nutshell, tells you what it's about.
You're doing a lot of readings. How's that going? What's it like?
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. I have one story in there especially that I – enjoy so much. It takes place at the Zen Center. It's a total fiction, but I used to belong to the Sonoma Mountain Zen Center out here in Santa Rosa. And it's really my favorite story. And I find myself, I keep reading it because I love reading it so much. But then I thought, there's a lot of stories I haven't read. So today I'm going to be reading it another venue. And so I'm going to do Zeus. Zeus is another difficult story.
Yes.
It's the myth where Zeus transforms himself into a swan and rapes Leda. And this is extremely, you know, Yeats wrote a very famous poem on it. And people have written on this many times. So it was particularly challenging for me, because I was thinking, how on earth am I going to have Zeus be a contemporary dude, you know, walking around, and how is he going to get himself to be a swan and rape somebody?
Yeah.
And also the subject of rape is sensitive.
Of course
and
it is.
Women are, you know, kind of a little nervous about that subject.
That's
so
right.
I'm interested in how it's going to go today, you know, whether people are going to go, oh, yikes, you know, and run, or whether they'll, you know, be sympathetic to the way it was done.
I was a little nervous myself in approaching that story.
Well, the one thing that I hope I made clear in that was Zeus was just as much a victim of history and himself and his own karma as the person he victimized. You know, in all of the stories, you know, there were a lot of things where, especially the men, were not that sympathetic. But I wanted to make sure that you could see where they were coming from,
yeah.
And so that you felt that there was this sort of encounter between the divine and the human, but each had their own issues, and they each kind of ensnared and entrapped each other in a way, you know. So, yeah.
And you captured the essence of the persona of each of them, and it made me reflect on the importance of those myths. Your book has, I think, a universal appeal.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to ask you, it's the gods and goddesses from the Greek and Roman mythology,
right,
who have stayed with us and who have more universal recognition.
Well, I think that what is appealing, you know, mm-hmm. these Greek and Roman gods had that human frail, you know, mm-hmm. they always had some kind of little, you know, Achilles heel, so to speak.
Achilles,
you
know? There's another name we recognize. Yes, yes.
You know, they always had a certain weakness or a tendency to overdo it, or they blew it, or they pursued somebody and
yes.
somebody turned into a tree, or,
yes,
you know, that
right.
kind of a thing. Yeah.
Right. So let me remind our listeners, I'm talking to Jean Wong, and that her website is under her name, Jean Wong. And the name of the book is Sleeping with the Gods, Immortal Stories. Right. I want to tell you, Jean, how happy I am to find a smaller size book. It's complete. You know, I want more, but this one is complete in itself. And it's easy to carry around. You can put it in your pocket. You can put it in your backpack. You can tuck it in under your pillow when you're reading it at night. I'm a terrific fan of smaller books. And I'm sure, did you deliberately set out to think, well, I'll keep this one small? It's how many pages? Is it 100
pages? It's 108
pages.
108 yeah, pages. Yeah.
Perfect.
But I didn't know. As a matter of fact, they were originally six, and I was talking to one person who considered publishing it with his small, very small press, and he said, "Would you, you know, consider adding a couple more stories to give the mm-hmm. collection a little more heft?" I love
yes.
that word, heft.
That's great.
and so I, you know, just pulled out three more stories out of the mm-hmm. hat, which I'm really glad I did because mm-hmm. it really seemed to round things out.
Mm-hmm.
But I know what you're saying. I mean, I have this. I mean, this is a pretty shallow confession, but when I go to the library, oftentimes I will just look down the shelf. And I'll pick the thinner volumes,
yes.
mainly because I feel if somebody can't say something, mm-hmm. it's going to take so long in this huge volume to mm-hmm. say something.
Yes.
You know, they're probably long-winded.
Yes.
You know, there's
long-winded.
A story to be told, and mm-hmm. you know, tell it.
Right.
You know, for goodness sakes,
yes.
just don't go on and
yes.
on and on about it. You know,
and
I felt mm-hmm. feel that way even about biographies. I mean, unless
yes.
you're doing really scholarly, comprehensive work, you know, make it interesting.
Yes.
Keep the reader engaged.
Yes, and don't tell me everything.
Yeah, right. I don't need to know everything.
The same thing
yeah.
about memoir. Don't tell
right.
me everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
Do you think you'll do more with gods and goddesses?
I haven't actually thought of it. I'm actually working now on – I've written a lot of memoir pieces, but they're memoir pieces unlike sort of your typical memoir where it's just telling you about the life. Each one of – in fact, I'm going to – the name of the story, name of the title is going to be Do You See Me Here? Which is the title of one of the stories. And then it'll say, Do You See Me Here? And Other Tales of Personal Folly. And the book will be divided up into things like mystery or insight or folly or, you know, so the chapters will not, instead of a memoir where you sort of talk about your life and kind of these sequence of things that happened to you, each of them will be stories, will be shaped as a story and stand out by itself. And it'll have, you know, kind of like that, what a story needs, a kind of arc and a good ending, a surprise ending and everything. So in that way, it's a little bit different than your, mm-hmm. you know, da-da-da-da type memoir. Hopefully it won't be boring.
I would read that story. Yes.
I just finished an essay, which I Yeah, I just posted it actually last week on my blog, which is what is story? And the thing that really occurs to me most of all is that, you know, if you get married and your husband cheats on you and you start drinking and then you commit suicide, that's not really a story. In other words, suffering is not a, you know, your tales of woe are not a story. And I have lots of tales of woe, but that's not going to be interesting to anybody. That's, you know, in fact, it'll just, it's a bummer to read about somebody's tale of woe, you know. So how do you take situations like that and somehow, you know, have maybe a tale of woe, but juxtapose it to another setting or something else where, you know, one part of the puzzle, you know, jumps across the room and fits into the other part of the puzzle and creates, you know, a story, a real story, you know. So,
how did you learn how to do that?
Well, that's what I, you know, sometimes I think that there is such a thing as a muse because, like in the one with Anne Girona, the story that was one of my favorite, an incident happened to me in real life, which was a woe is me story. And I kept thinking, well, how am I going to, you know, da 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 da. And, you know, puzzle did jump it, and I went, aha, you know. So I think there is that kind of muse. People talk about that.
There's
a
muse.
There seems to be something that just sort of all of a sudden you go, you know, there it is, as clear. Mm-hmm. And some of the things I've written, I can hardly believe that it was written by me. I mean, I'll look at it and I said, how did I cough that one up?
Jean, one of my favorite stories in the book is the first one about Mercury. And people who know me will know why I immediately glommed onto it, because it has a ukulele in it. Of course. he has a ukulele of Kona wood, and so do I. So I bonded with him immediately. But would you read a portion of the beginning of the story of Mercury?
Okay. And, of course, each story has a little description of the god there. And in the beginning, Mercury, it says, Mercury, the messenger god, who wore winged sandals. He made a lyre, filched cattle, and is known for thievery. Later, after Kailani gave it some thought, she realized it was impossible. He couldn't have come out of the ocean with a ukulele in his hand. But that's how she remembered him, the sun behind him like a halo, salt water dripping down the instrument's soft koa wood. Recently divorced, she was licking her wounds on the shores of Kauai, sprawled longer than was comfortable in the hot sun, trying to read a book with a drink that had grown warm. This is what she'd yearned for, but it seemed unlikely that even the gods could have sent her someone so utterly handsome, creamy golden tan, thick bundles of blonde locks, eyes that shimmered with facets of blue and green. Was there even an occasional flare of violet? He plopped himself down beside her. She waited for the pickup line. Do you have the time? Can I borrow a match? Weren't you at the party last night? Do you play? He proffered the ukulele, his long tapered fingers wrapped around the instrument's neck. He smiled with such immediacy and confidence, she was certain his overtures towards women were never turned down. Kailani was probably one of the few people that day on the beach who did indeed know how to play, and she eerily sensed that was why he had approached her. Cradling the small, figure-eight-shaped ukulele in one arm, she strummed Ke Kale Nehao, the Hawaiian wedding song, the most beautiful and famous song of the islands. Their eyes locked, as if in a ceremony between them had already taken place. In rare harmony, they sang the final lines. Ele, ele, oe now, oe now. Ele, oe now. You play well. You sing well, she replied. Where are you from? I'm a planet unto myself, he smiled. But looking at you, it's hard to remember where I ever was or will be. The smile dissolved. His eyes turned inward as if remembering a forgotten past. Actually, I'm from Chile. My father had the first vineyard there. They called him King of the Grapes. But then he got into the armament business. He paused. It was as if unable to break away from some memory. That changed him. There are many stories to tell about those days. The corners of his mouth tightened. He blinked, as if he'd just become aware of her again. When his eyes settled languorously on her, she was glad she had picked a splashy hibiscus and tucked it behind her ear. Under his inspection, she gave a toss of her head, her rich, dark hair swinging to one side in endless, thick strands. She was used to tourists taking note of her exotic Eurasian cast, part Hawaiian, with a nose that carried a perky tilt from some Caucasian ancestry. "King of the grapes," Kailani said. "My grandfather was called King of Taro, the plant we used to make poi. He lived in Honolulu." "And we are royalty," he exclaimed. His face flickered joyfully like a candle. "I am real royalty," she boasted, "but I deign to call you cousin." "Then we are prince and princess," he jumped up and took her hand. "Come, let us run and reign." They scampered like children, laughing, zigzagging in and out of the water. She would never have been able to keep up with them if he hadn't been holding her hand. His feet lifted from the ground as if in flight. Nimble, quick, lunging, turning, leaping, they flew together down the edge of the shore, up through the foliage and trees, darting in and around picnic tables, finally collapsing under a great coconut palm. "You're faster than a beam of light," she panted. "And you are a dazzling sprite of grace," he countered. He took her hand. "I see your fingers were created for harps and instruments with strings. But your hands, they are the hands of a dancer, a weaver, a spinner of the finest filaments of gold." Like an enchantment, sapphire pools gleamed in his eyes. "And you," she found herself saying, "are the master of the spoken line, a teller of tales, the god of games, the alchemist of words." Afternoon passed into twilight as they continued their light, fanciful bantering charged with jubilant energy. They watched dazed, as if for the first time, the sky arch over them with gentle strands of pinks, oranges, purples, the island's final act of loveliness before nightfall. "Did you want to see my place?" he asked almost shyly. "I think I have a pizza in the freezer." "I'm starving," she said. They stared at one another. Everything they did seemed ordinary and at the same time otherworldly. Sometimes Kailani felt like they were acting parts they'd played many lifetimes before. "What is your name?" she whispered, almost as if she already knew the answer. "Mercury," he said.
Beautiful. That was Jean Wong reading from her just-published book called Sleeping with the Gods, Immortal Stories. Oh, Jean, you read that so beautifully. And I love every detail in it. When she first discovers the sapphire in his eyes, and then later you refer back to it. Beautifully done. Uh-huh. Oh, congratulations. It's a lovely book.
Thank you.
Jean, is there anything else you'd like to talk about that your listeners would like to know about you or your work?
Well, it was just it's a lot of fun to write, and I think it'll be a lot of fun to read. I just hope that people won't be put off with the idea that this is about Roman and Greek gods, and it's some kind of boring, thing under some tomb. It's definitely not. These are all contemporary situations, and I hope readers will be able to connect to it in their own personal lives.
I hope so, too. And the hard work that you put into the writing makes it easy for the reader. And the writer does the work, and the reader gets to enjoy it. So thank you so much for putting together this book, and I look forward to more of your writing.
Well, thanks so much.
And
it's
thanks so much for coming in. I've been talking to Jean Wong. Her last name is Wong, W-O-N-G, spelling it, so you'll be sure to get to the website where you can find out how to get her book. You can also get it on Amazon, and I'm sure the word will spread. Yeah.
Thanks,
Jean.
Thank you, Rosemary Manchester and Jean Wong. Jean's book is Sleeping with the Gods. Earlier in the broadcast, I spoke with Elizabeth Evans, whose book is As Good as Dead. I'm Suzanne Lang. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight and Mary Moore Campagna. You can listen to us the first Sunday of every month right here on KRCB Radio 91. And you can catch up on previous shows or listen to us anytime online at krcb.org. subscribe to our podcasts, and listen in iTunes or any player of your choice. We'll go out with a tune from Eileen Jewell, Songbird, from her album Sundown Over Ghost Town. Thanks so much for listening.
Oh, songbird, in my darkest night, you sing so sweetly I can't be afraid. Over my path your song casts a light so bright, so real, I won't lose my way. I set true north by you, so all directions to. Songbird, what did I do before you? What did I do before you? Oh, songbird, in my weariest day, a few clear notes is all I need. And I see without warning a precious ray of magic in each ordinary thing. You illuminate, renew, take the sad out of the blue. Songbird, what would I do without you? What would I do without you? How'd you get so strong, such a little thing? Is it your song that makes you brave? My whole world rests on those tiny wings, but you don't seem to mind the weight. I set true north by you, and so all directions too. Songbird, what did I do before you? What did I do before you? Sad out of the blue. Songbird, what would I do without you? What would I do without you?
It's KRCB's A Novel Idea.